If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, The Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damian Thompson. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, is back in the headlines again. On Sunday, he was interviewed by the BBC's Laura Kunzberg about the circumstances that led to his resignation last year, his failure to act over the horrible predatory crimes of John Smythe, a powerful lay Anglican lawyer who's said to have abused 130 boys in Britain and Africa before he died in 2018.
Would you like the victims of John Smythe to forgive you?
Obviously, but it's not about me. When we talk about safeguarding, the centre of it is are the victims and survivors. I have never, ever said to a survivor, you must forgive, because that is their sovereign, absolute, individual choice. Everyone wants to be forgiven, but to demand forgiveness is to abuse again.
The Makin report, though, the official report into this, does suggest, it says it's really unlikely that you didn't know anything before 2013.
You can believe it or not, I did not have a clue.
You wrote, to forgive is not to pretend that nothing's happened. It's the opposite. It accepts the full weight of the wrong. Do you forgive John Smythe?
Yes.
I don't think Justin Welby intended Sunday's biggest headline to be Welby says he forgives serial abuser John Smythe. But it was, and it was a blunder on the former Archbishop's part, though I think it is worth reading the whole quote. Kunzberg asked him if he would forgive Smythe, and he said, yes, I think if he was alive and I saw him, but it's not me he's abused. He's abused the victims and survivors, so whether I forgive him or not is, to a large extent, irrelevant. So he did make that caveat pretty quickly, and maybe we can write that down as unfortunate, or perhaps a little bit of a trap laid for him. And Welby did address perhaps his biggest blunder, that is, after failing to chase down Smythe and hold him to account. And that was his disastrous farewell speech in the House of Lords, when he said, if you pity anyone, pity my poor diary secretary, who'd seen weeks and months of work disappear in a puff of a resignation announcement. And Welby said on Sunday that he wasn't in a good space at the time and wishes he hadn't said it. Well, I've always found it rather difficult to assess Justin Welby, who I thought was going to be a much better Archbishop of Canterbury than he turned out to be. At times he's self-effacingly humble, other times arrogant, and he's always been accused of a managerial style in which he bent his employees to his will. But it's also really quite difficult to assess his culpability in the John Smythe case. I mean, the extent of it, not the fact of it. And to talk about this latest controversy, I'm joined by the Reverend Fergus Butler Galley, editor-at-large of Fence magazine and the new vicar of Chalbury in Oxfordshire. Fergus, great to have you on Holy Smoke. Can you give me your reaction to Justin Welby's latest comments, which, perhaps rather less culpably than before, seem to have gone off the rails in a way he didn't intend? But on the other hand, you can understand why he does seem to have a tin ear and why victims really do feel aggrieved.
Absolutely. Thank you, firstly, for having me on. It's lovely to be here. Yes, I think to go back to your point about him being a worse archbishop than was expected, one of the things we were told was that in sort of contrast to otherworldly Rehan Williams and his sort of druidic style, Justin Welby was going to be a man of the moment who could deal with the realities of 24/7 news, deal with the realities of being an archbishop in the 21st century. And I think, if anything, this latest interview has sort of confirmed to me that that was always not true, that actually there was a tin-earedness, perhaps, as you said it, or maybe a kind of a real disconnect between how he saw himself and how he saw the narrative evolving and the actual reality. And in fact, he was either very badly advised or simply did not have the personal instincts or the personal skills necessary to navigate that. And I think we saw that when the storm broke over the Smythe allegations. But it really, that was what really was hammered home to me in that interview. Because, of course, what he was putting forward was, it was, you know, a kind of basic Christian instinct to forgive. Now, I think, again, I would have qualified it a bit more and said, you know, had I seen Smythe and he had repented, then forgiveness would have been something that was on the table. But he didn't qualify it with that. And again, I'm afraid that we have a media that was out to undermine the church more generally, I think. I think there was a sense whereby actually in some cases, I think the victims were used by Channel 4 and latterly the BBC as a stick. I'm not sure they became, you know, the story became, they became less interested in the story of the individuals as soon as the headline of the Archbishop going was achieved. But yes, fundamentally, there is a problem there that I'm not sure another interview by the Archbishop was what was required. I think a period of repentance and reflection, a period of perhaps more meaningful engagement with those victims who do still feel very aggrieved, would have been a more effective way of safeguarding his legacy, if that was indeed what he was intending to do, than this interview.
I agree completely. I always thought, I talked to Michael Gove about this at the time, we did an interview. Really, one of the most egregious aspects of Welby's response to this was his failure to meet and talk to the victims for years after it had become clear what Smythe had done. And let's not forget that, you know, Welby moved in the same rather privileged evangelical circles as Smythe long before his ordination, and he had heard the stories. And then he didn't meet the victims, even when it was, you know, safe for him to do so, as it were.
Absolutely. I think there was a model of, you know, public repentance, public engagement that could have been dealt with. And instead, there was this constant hiding behind, or appeared to be hiding behind, procedure. And this is the kind of fundamental disconnect here that I still don't think Welby gets, and I don't think the managerial cast of the Church of England gets, that you can be following all of the rules, you can be saying and doing all the things that the piece of paper in your policy tells you to do, and you can still be doing something that is wrong, and something that fundamentally will look appalling to any ordinary member of the public with a moral compass. And therefore, there is this kind of, and you can then say, oh, well, the structures aren't fit for purpose. Fine, but you are the Archbishop of Canterbury. You are not bound by those structures. You are bound by what you believe to be, frankly, the moral course for the whole nation. That is part of what you're meant to be there to do. And modelling a degree of repentance and engagement with those who have been wronged, I would have thought would have been, just in terms of PR, even before you get to the theology, front and centre of how he should have reacted.
Do you think Archbishop Welby would have been better at his job if his background hadn't been so unusual, so atypical? Now, although you've done lots of different jobs, you've been a clergyman since you were a very young man. Welby had a very privileged background, went to Eton and Trinity Cambridge, and then became the treasurer of a city law firm, and then through the HDB network, eventually got ordained. But his background was very much in finance, in business. He was, I suppose, if not a member of the upper classes, then closely connected to it. And he had an exceedingly managerial mindset. Do you think that if he were a more conventional career clergyman, he might have handled this sort of thing better?
I think, yes, frankly. I think there are two things at play. One, there is the kind of the personal trajectory himself and the fact that it coincided at just the wrong time for the Church of England. Someone said to me that we actually had our archbishops the wrong way round, in that had Welby been there during the kind of procedural nitty-gritty that besets the Church of England in the early 21st century, the issues around the ordination of women, the issues around reconciliation in synod, etc., Welby actually might have managed that better, because it probably did need someone to cut through some of the kind of molasses-like procedural debate. But what he lacked, I think, was that ability to speak to something more profound, or something deeper, in a way that Rowan Williams, for his, you know, perhaps difficulties in that sense, could. So yes, I think the fact that he came along at a time when the Church of England thought, ah, we need a magic wand in the form of someone who understands the secular world, was actually fatal for both parties. It was a really dangerous thing because there was a sense where he could come in and impose secular models on the church and on particularly the appointments of senior figures, copying the civil service, etc. And everybody thought, oh, well, that's obviously the way we solve our problem. Of course, it actually made things worse because it created a completely secular structure to how we appoint people, which removes a sense of vocation from it. It removes, I think, a sense of being able to speak in theological terms or speak profoundly to the nation or to the diocese or to the wider church. And actually, I think it meant that when these scandals broke, he became completely bound by the structures he had created. So there's that level. And then I think there is also the slightly different level, which I think is interrelated, which you mentioned, which is the link to HTB and the fact that there has been this group within the Church of England for whom the kind of capture, for want of a better word, of the leadership has been a matter of policy for 50 odd years since the evangelicals under John Stott in the 1970s. You know, there was a move where some of them said, we need to leave the Church of England. It's apostate, it's liberal Catholic, it's bad. And Stott tells them to stay, and they build up, the bash camps, etc. There is a policy. How can we train people for senior leadership, but in our own structures, not within the structures of the Church of England?
That's true. I was talking to James Orr on this programme a few weeks ago, and we're making more or less the same point about the influence of HTB. And I made the point that HTB, I think, has changed a lot. But also, and James agreed with me, they didn't get what they were expecting in Justin Welby. I mean, you said for many of the old style HTB or St. Helens Bishopsgate evangelicals, you know, the liberal Catholic flavor that really was flavor of the decade in the Church of England, more than the decade, perhaps the century.
The decades, yeah.
Indeed. And in some respects, that's what they got with Justin Welby, who, if you look at one of his liturgies, there he is in a chasuble celebrating something that looks like a Novus Ordo Mass and parroting the sort of woke platitudes that would come from any clergyman anywhere across the theological spectrum, but from almost any liberal denomination. So I don't think, but on the other hand, the sort of disciplinarian approach, the control freak side of Welby, that didn't go away, I don't think. And I've talked to so many Anglican clergy friends of mine who found it enormously difficult to get through to Lambeth Palace or felt they were being pushed around by it, felt that it truly had become impregnable and very arrogant under Welby's regime, which is not the way he looked on camera or sounds.
No, I think both of those points are absolutely right. You had this thing where, I've got on my print here, my wall here, Father Tooth, who, was famously sent to prison for lighting candles. Yeah. None of that matters. In some ways, the liberal Catholics have won. You know, everything looks and sounds exactly how, as you say, a Novus Ordo, how a Jesuit would have it circa 1960-something. But...
Or circa 2025.
Circa 2025, yeah, quite. But you're right, that there is this sort of sense where HT, in one sense, HTB fell, but one thing that Welby did take from that world was that, and which he also took from the secular world, was this kind of cast iron discipline and the kind of towing of a party line. I think we saw that really very strongly during COVID, when there clearly was dissent in the House of Bishops about the policy. There were bishops there who were saying, you know what, I think this isn't such a great idea. And that was slapped down. There was no public dissent that was allowed. And he's also done, and I'm sure we will get onto this, he has mirrored what Pope Francis has done in terms of, you know, the bench of bishops has been remade in his image. There is almost nobody who has not been appointed under these new structures, these new managerialist structures that ape the civil service and the secular world. And so you have people who, even if their instincts are not the same as Welby's, to have got to where they are, they have to have at least towed the line to a certain level. And it becomes very hard once you reach that point to escape from the thought prison that you've been put in.
He took the president of the Royal College of Nursing, Dame Sarah Mullally, who admittedly was a non-stipendary minister and then went into ministry and then was briefly Bishop of Crediton, which isn't even a diocesan see, and then was suddenly Bishop of London, much to the disgruntlement of lots of female clergy.
Indeed, the most difficult and
decades
dysfunctional. Exactly. And that's a classic sort of Welby appointment where there is this idea that you can just cut across the idea of balance. Because historically, of course, you know, the Church of England, you know, had this sort of policy of balancing liberals and conservatives, Catholics and evangelicals. There was an attempt to kind of, you know, make a sort of wobbly mess, perhaps, but you did try and appoint people with, you know, Welby cut across that. Now, I should say part of the blame here does lie with Gordon Brown and the changes there, which is why I say, again, Welby came at just the wrong time, that Gordon Brown had abdicated the role, really, of the appointment secretary. He had really removed any influence from Number 10 or from the palace. And so you're left with these, as you are with so many spheres in our national life, these kind of completely amorphous, unaccountable quangos, boards, bodies that the same sorts of people sit on who were tasked with nominating names for senior.
Exactly. And the whole question of churchmanship, which used to be so important when I was a young reporter covering the Church of England, it was so desperately important, you know, which brand of evangelical, which there were 13 flavors at least in Anglo-Catholicism. And you could tell how high a bishop was by the color of his cassock. Mm-hmm. I'm not kidding. And in a way, churchmanship has been subsumed into a managerial ethos. And sometimes it's quite difficult to guess where, as they put it these days, bishops don't say I'm evangelical or Catholic or broad church or anything. They say, well, that was where I'm coming from. That's the formula they like. But I mean, one used to think of Stephen Cottrell, the Archbishop of York, who, let me put on the record, I think is utterly useless. one of the worst platitude merchants in the entire Church of England, which is saying something, though, of course, Catholics can give them a run for their money, but also serious questions about his own competence dealing with abusers. Sorry to get sidetracked, but let me ask you, how on earth does Stephen Cottrell, I know he's Archbishop of York, but A, how does he become Archbishop of York? And secondly, how does he end up with all these angry claims about his mismanagement of cases? How does he end up running the show when Welby steps down?
I think it is a mystery. I mean, I dug out the other day a video from 2021, not that long ago, where Cottrell was cozying up for a series of videos with Russell Brand. Now, everybody...
Oh, I can just imagine.
Everybody, I know, both in these kind of cod Essex accents, kind of trying to be, you know, I have links. Everybody in media and in print and TV journalism knew about Brand at that point. There were legal, you know, challenges that meant the mass reporting didn't really come out till a little bit later, but it was widely known. So either there is a kind of willful disregard in the pursuit of slaps on the back in the world of social media and the news, or there is a profound incompetence in terms of back-checking and all the rest of it, and he's being terribly advised. But either way, how you can think that this is the person whose judgment is now sufficient to steer the Church of England through its next stage strikes me as completely mad. And again, it leads back to that problem of this managerial cast who just do not get it and who think that, you know, once the story is passed, they, if they just carry on sailing through, they can get away with it.
Well, you mentioned Pope Francis earlier, and although I know people regard this as my hobby horse, I'm very glad to have it as my hobby horse because very few people are speaking up for the victims of his predator allies, whom he is, insofar as he's able to, protecting to this day. But I wondered if I could read you something written by one of the world's most distinguished Anglican professors of history. You'll know him well, Philip Jenkins, who's a professor of history at Baylor University in Texas, originally Welsh. And he wrote just this month, "Repeatedly, there have been cases, mostly arising from South America, where senior clerics have been credibly accused of serious sexual misconduct or abuse, and consistently, Francis has failed to respond in any credible way, even when he assuredly knew what was happening. He has defended or promoted the accused perpetrators while denouncing the victims. Throughout, Vatican interventions have been deliberately opaque and public statements wildly misleading. In some cases of historical abuse, you can make the case that standards and approaches were very different in earlier eras." And of course, that's an argument people make about the Church of England as well. Anyway, resume the quote. "And we have to understand the charges against that background. Those arguments do not apply here. We are talking about the 2010s and 2020s. I won't go into these recent cases in detail here, says Professor Jenkins, but you can check out serial horror stories in Argentina, Father Giulio Grassi, Father Ariel Alberto Principi, Bishop Gustavo Zancheta, and in Chile, Father Fernando Caradima, Bishop Juan Barros Madrid. The Zancheta case was egregious, my God it was. And if it had occurred in the context of any other church leader in modern times, it would certainly have forced a resignation. What Francis did and did not do in that case alone went way beyond the misconduct that recently forced the removal of the Anglican primate Justin Welby. See also Francis's response to the case of artist Father Marco Rupnik. That's the credibly accused rapist of nuns who's currently being given sanctuary in a convent, of all places. The whole thing is so grotesque. You understand why I have to make the comparison, and I think that Professor Jenkins is absolutely right when he says, and let's hear that quote again, what Francis did and didn't do went way beyond the misconduct that recently forced the removal of Justin Welby. What do you think?
Yes, I think that's undoubtedly true. There are very interesting parallels between Justin Welby and Pope Francis, as there were between their respective predecessors, actually. I think a convincing kind of narrative that both were kind of appointed in reaction to imagined failings of their predecessors, and in retrospect, those were mistakes. And I think Pope Benedict and Rowan Williams an apology in terms of how I think a lot of people thought in 2013, etc., this was going to play out. And I think we are seeing the darker side of that, very frankly autocratic manner that Welby and Francis have in common. But yes, I think inevitably, because of the particular authority of the Pope within the Catholic Church compared to the comparative authority of the Archbishop of Canterbury, there is a great deal more personal culpability. I think the details, as you say, are harrowing in some of those cases. It's very sad when you've dealt with this sort of world of clerical abuse, you become a little bit inoculated sometimes to the nature of this stuff. It becomes difficult to be shocked, sadly. I was shocked.
And one of the reasons people aren't as shocked as they might be is that the details of, for example, Rupnik's crimes or alleged crimes are so grotesque and pornographic that it wouldn't even be appropriate for me to read them out on a podcast like this. And in case after case after case, Francis has, it would appear, actively conspired to shelter people from justice in a way that Welby did not actively conspire to shelter Smythe from justice, however egregious his failings.
Yes.
And this is what's unbelievably shocking. And, you know, where are the crowds in St. Peter's Square, you know, saying tearful rosaries for the victims of Francis's friends?
And I do wonder whether, you know, after the reign of Francis is over, no matter what form the end of that reign takes, it might be abdication, as I think has been discussed before, you know, or, you know, he is a man in his late 80s in poor health. No matter what form that takes, I think it is perfectly possible that there is a kind of reckoning. Because, I mean, let's remember that the real reckoning with Smythe happened actually after his death. I mean, of course, there was the move to Africa. There were
everybody in Rome is saying this. Wait till he dies; it'll all come out.
But
hide away.
Exactly. But I mean, that shows, you know, have neither of these churches learned anything from the previous 30 odd years of revelations? Where this is the question, or is it simply the case? And I fear this might be right, that in fact, for all that the factions that Francis and Welby respectively represented in their respective churches, for all of their claims to be a new broom, in fact, it is simply the case that if someone on your side does it, you can find ways to excuse it. And I fear that might be the case.
Could I ask you, Fergus, as a priest of the Church of England who represents traditional Anglicanism, although a dynamic Anglicanism, like Marcus Walker. There's definitely a revival there, just as there's a Tridentine revival in the Catholic Church. Can you envisage a model in which the Church of England, inevitably hugely shrunken, just like the Roman Catholic Church, can regain its credibility or regain public trust on this subject?
Yes, I can. But I think it is a model that is exceptionally unpalatable to the current leadership, because it, I think it would involve a clearing out of the current leadership. And I mean bishops appointed under Justin Welby and by the structures that Justin Welby enabled. I think it would involve a massive repeal of some of the legislation that has put those people in place. I think it would involve a possibly even going back to a restructuring of the finances of the church that happened in the 1970s. You know, I think it has to be based on the local. John Keble famously said, you know, if the Church of England should fail, you will find it in my parish. And I think what that has to be, where the Church of England can regain any sense of credibility is by putting good parish priests in at the level of parish ministry and regaining it from the absolute ground up. I don't think it can actually regain its credibility in terms of simply putting a new leader in, speaking the same kind of managerial platitudes. But what I would say is that neither of the churches is unique in this. We have a kind of, I always tell people that I think Welby is more symptom than cause. And I think the Church of England is canary in the coal mine for the institutions across the country that are being run by a class of people who are A, not up to the job, B, exist in the same thought world as each other, and C, have imposed managerial structures that are now failing in a very radical way. And we are seeing the breakdown institutionally of things across the country.
And everything you say applies to the Vatican and to the Catholic Church throughout the world. The next pope needs to sack just about every single head of every dicastery and get rid of the vast majority of cardinal archbishops.
Yep. And the Church of England, exactly the same.
Let's say a very healthy proportion of them. Yeah. As for financial restructuring, well, maybe we've gone beyond that point. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the rediscovery of parish life is a necessary but not sufficient condition for both our churches, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, I mean, fundamentally, that is where people are going to engage with God. That is where people are going to encounter the message of Christ. It's where they will see faith, hope, and charity in action. And so actually part of it is, and I say this as you've said, an old high churchman, high and dry, a very, as you say, an unusual but interestingly growing model. I believe intellectually in bishops. You know, I think they are necessary to the good order of the church. I think they are it is a command of Christ that the structure of the church is such. However, I think we need bishops who have a radically different understanding of what that practically means and their job. Frankly, I think the role of our senior pastors should be to support the parish priests on the front line, not to suck, you know, energy, morale, and finances from them. And I'm afraid that is the direction of travel.
I couldn't agree more. Reverend Fergus Butler-Galley, so glad you could join us.
Thank you.
Look forward to our next conversation.
Lovely to speak to you.